D-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby.
Shiba, shiba. Shiba, shiba. Shiba, shiba.
Let me in.
Shiba, shiba.
I want to be closer to you.
Shiba, shiba.
Open up your soul.
Shiba, shiba.
Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your
mind. Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello. And welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. Today's show will partially be a rebroadcast of a scintillating science show I did last year. And then later on, we'll be speaking to the director of Babes in Holland. But I just wanted to give you a heads up that the interview that I did had a little bit of a technical glitch, but I edited that out. But you will notice a sort of a jump in the narrative, but you will still learn something. So do enjoy. I have a scintillating scientist waiting to tell you all about vulnerable ecosystems. I'd like to welcome Sienna Tillman. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm well.
So, Sienna, before we get into what you do, tell me, when did you first get interested in the sciences?
Yeah, so I grew up in Sacramento, California.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in Monterey now, but about 3 hours away in the Central Valley. And I'm focusing on marine biology now. And anyone who's familiar with Sacramento knows that it's not that close to the ocean, and where I grew up, there's like not a whole lot of nature to expose yourself to. So my first exposures with natural ecosystems and having curiosity about those was through my dad's fish tank at home and TV and movies. So when I was little, I would watch the fish in my dad's fish tank. He had a lot of African cichlids, which are these beautiful, colorful freshwater fish from Africa.
Uh-huh.
And I would sort of think about how they interacted with each other, how things that we did or didn't do could offset the balance in the tank, and sort of what were the mechanisms behind that. That's sort of what got me thinking about how ecosystems work.
Uh-huh.
And even just things as mundane as when I would come home and watch The Little Mermaid on repeat and wonder why she wanted to leave the ocean, mm-hmm. and not understanding how she wasn't fascinated by all the creatures there, all the ways there are to be alive. And so that's sort of what got me into being curious about the sciences. And mm-hmm. so ever since that's been something that I knew that I had a curiosity about, I just sort of followed paths through education that have taken me there.
Okay, so when you were little and you're fascinated by the fish, did you just pepper your dad with millions of questions, and was he able to answer all your questions?
I absolutely did, and I know he would love for me to tell you all that he answered every single question and knew everything,
uh-huh.
and he did his very best, and I learned a lot. But no, he couldn't answer all my questions. I think he has some experience keeping tanks,
mm-hmm.
and he was able to tell me about nitrogen levels and certain diseases that the fish could get and things you can do to prevent those things and
mm-hmm.
sort of keep the ecosystem in balance, how the males behave differently than the females, how they show color differently, and all of that was
uh-huh.
very interesting.
Uh-huh.
But he wasn't able to translate what happens in a tank into what happens in the real world and how that affects people. And so that's something that I wanted to sort of find out on my own and take further with it.
Okay. So then did you go to bookstores and buy lights? Did you have like a lot of under the sea books growing up, or was it something that you covered in the classroom, or did you not come to it till you went into higher learning?
Yeah, I think it would be lovely for me to say that I was always an avid reader, and I was picking up books here and there. But really, for me, like I said, it was TV and movies that was where I learned a lot about nature. So, of course, when you're really little, this started as like animated films, which I'm still really fond of. And a lot of those are set in nature. And as I got older, I sought out kind of more serious scientific lenses. So this could be like nature documentaries. I was obsessed with Animal Planet. And because I just didn't have a lot of nature where I grew up, that was kind of my lens, my portal to being able to sort of access these different worlds. And because I knew I had that desire, when I finally got the chance to apply to colleges, I decided, okay, I'm going to apply to places that are not only in proximity to the kind of nature that I'm interested in, but also have programs that allow me to explore how it works and study those kinds of things.
So where did you end up going to college? Which college met all those requirements for you?
Yeah, so I had a couple considerations, but I ended up choosing the University of California, Santa Cruz, so UC Santa Cruz. If there's any banana slugs out there.
You were saying about being in Santa Cruz and being close to the redwoods and being close to the sea. So what was that experience like for you when you were finally, you go from being someplace that's entirely landlocked to a place that is teeming with everything you could possibly want?
Yeah, I mean, surreal almost. I mean, for one, it was a lot colder than I was ready for. In the valley, we get summers that get up to like 113.
Yikes.
And so Santa Cruz in the summer would get 70, 80. In the winter, colder than that, a lot more rain. So like, I just don't think I really had a concept of what weather could be like. And I know that's mild probably for a lot of people listening. But it was also just really surreal, like I said, to just walk around the forest on your way to class and see the sun shine through the leaves, see banana slugs on your way. Occasionally you'd see something really cool like a bobcat or some deer. And that was just like a part of your everyday life. It took me a while to get used to. And also as I transitioned to being on the coastal campus more, being able to see the ocean from wherever you are.
Yes.
And see whales breaching sometimes, see otters. It's a little bit unreal to think that I knew when I was watching these nature documentaries that this stuff was real and that it existed, but it feels very different when it's right in front of you.
Yes.
And you can reach out and touch some of it and sort of experience it in real time.
So when you went to college, did you immediately sign up for the sciences, or were you what was the journey to get to where you are now?
Yeah, for sure. So because I knew I had a curiosity for nature, I went in with a proposed major of marine biology. I've always been really interested in just how many different ways there are to be alive. And I think the ocean is one of the best reflections of the diversity that life has to offer. And so I wanted to explore that. I didn't know if I was going to stick with it. In a lot of ways, I was nervous that I wouldn't be able to. So I'm a first-generation student. I'm a Black student. And in a lot of ways, marine biology is not something that seemed like it was for me, or there wasn't a lot of representation of people like me doing this. I hadn't had experience being on boats at all. I didn't go to the ocean all the time. This was just very much me making decisions based off of innate curiosity for something. And I'm so glad that I did. But it wasn't me knowing, oh, I'm going to be good at this. I'm going to love this. It's going to be incredible. It was sort of just taking a swing based on some of the things that I'd seen on TV and thinking, I want to know what that's like. And while I was there, I started in the sciences. You take a lot of general education classes. So you take like physics and bio and chem and certain math classes. But then you're also taking classes in the arts and humanities, because there are other requirements to make sure that you're sort of a well-rounded citizen by the time that you graduate. And so I did end up sticking with the science, because I found that the curiosity that I knew I had really kind of aligned with some of the work that was being done at UC Santa Cruz. And some of the classes that I was in were really diving into some of the questions that I had that my father couldn't answer for me, or that maybe the nature documentaries don't go into all the way. And so I found myself just sort of chasing that curiosity as much as I could.
I love hearing that, because I know that there are a lot of other people out there who can feel it's a bit daunting to be the first in your family or the first of your particular ethnic group to be in a particular place. And you just went for it and it paid off for you.
So far. I mean, there's still a lot of journey left.
Yeah.
That I'm excited about. But yeah, I don't regret trying at all. And I think it can be really scary and difficult to show up to classes and be the only one every time, or mm-hmm. to see people who have been scuba diving for years, who have been surfing for years, who go on bike rides with their families. I mean, I grew up in a family where we didn't go camping because my dad didn't understand why we would play homeless, right? Like, he was the type of guy that was like, I work 3 jobs for a roof over your head. We're not going to pretend we don't have one for mm-hmm, a weekend, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not that they didn't appreciate nature, but it was just not a priority like it is for other people growing up. And I think when I got to UC Santa Cruz especially, it was really apparent how different my background was from the people I was in class with. Mm-hmm. And that can be really isolating and really terrifying. And I think if you don't have that drive or that curiosity or that thing fueling you that says, I want to see, for me, it was just this desire to discover things, to not stay in Sacramento my whole life. I love Sacramento, no mm-hmm. shade to Sacramento, mm-hmm. but there's so much out there and I just had a desire to see it. And I think science was kind of the way that felt feasible for me to realize some of these dreams. But without that kind of fire, that passion that I feel like I have and, mm-hmm. and definitely had back then, I don't think that it would have been something that I could just get through for the sake of doing. It is very difficult to be in those spaces.
Sure. So now you are working towards your PhD. Tell me what you're working, what the PhD is toward.
Yeah, so I'm working in community ecology, which is kind of like studying, rather than one species, studying how a group of species work together, how they interact with each other, how they interact with their environment. Mm-hmm. And specifically, I'm doing that in some of the kelp forests off the coast of California, but mm-hmm. also in seagrasses and coral reefs in Palau, and using some really fun new genetic technologies to try and see how we can better understand what species are in a given place, mm-hmm. how they interact with each other, and how changes in the environment can motivate the way that they move, the way that they feed, the way that they inhabit space, things like that.
So tell me a little bit about, like, what are some of the coral reefs that are out there? And I know that the climate change is having a massive effect on everything, but what other types of changes affect the coral reefs? And are there changes that affect them in a positive way?
Yeah. So right now, my research is based in Palau, which is an island in Micronesia in the Pacific. It's one of the Pacific islands. Mm-hmm. And they have several gorgeous coral reefs. And they also have seagrass communities. And so you mentioned sort of climate change and anthropogenic or human-based stressors sort of altering the way that these ecosystems work, right? And mm-hmm. so a lot of my research is based in that, specifically thinking about in Palau, there's a lot of decline in seagrass communities. So the area of coverage that seagrasses usually inhabit are declining pretty rapidly, and they've been monitoring this since 2011. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my research revolves around, okay, why is this happening? But also, what is the impact on communities of fish that rely on these habitats? Mm-hmm. And that spills over to coral reefs that you were talking about, because seagrass communities, seagrass habitats, tend to be really great nursery habitat for reef fish. So okay. when reef fish are essentially babies, right, they're larvae, before they settle onto the reef, they often pick habitats like mangroves or seagrasses where they're protected from predators, where they have time to feed and grow and be big enough to compete for space on the reef where all the big, bad adults are, right? Uh-huh. So understanding how the decline in seagrass affects the reef community is really important, because replenishing the populations of the reef is a big part of what seagrasses do. And so my research right now is working with collaborators to see, okay, what could be causing this? Is it eutrophication, which basically means runoff of nutrients from agriculture or farming? Could it be unclean water? So any sewage outlets that are leading to the change in seagrass coverage? Could it be something like climate change? So warming waters, making it to where the conditions aren't conducive to seagrass growth or survival. And so sort of going through a different kind of stressor or a bunch of lists of stressors that could be working to inhibit seagrass growth, or in combination, they can be working to inhibit seagrass growth, and looking at how specifically communities of fish is what my interest is.
Okay. So, then let me ask you this, since you're working on an island, is it possible to get, pure areas so that you can say, well, in this area there's runoff, but over here there's not runoff? Like how are you able to suss out what is actually causing it in your research?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And there's a lot of different ways you can do that. One of the really cool things about Palau is that if you aren't a Palauan citizen, you're not able to own land there, which is really cool, because it has a lot of implications for equity. But beyond that, it makes a cool study system because it's not hugely developed in certain areas. So they have a big urban center, which is Kolor, their capital. But there are places where the island is uninhabited at all. And then there are places that are kind of in between. So there's this really nice gradient of urbanization, of human density, which allows us to kind of form this natural experiment, right? Where we're saying, okay, in seagrasses that are nearer to this dense human population, are we seeing significant differences based on some of these factors versus in areas of the island where there isn't a huge human population, or maybe it's completely uninhabited? And sort of using the gradient that already exists on this island as an opportunity to sort of do an experiment with controls and treatments without having to sort of dump waste into the water or manipulate the environment in any sort of way.
So what are your findings thus far?
Yeah, so I'm in my second year of my PhD, so a lot of the work so far has been learning methods to use, kind of conceiving of this project, communicating with writers. But what we do know so far is that within and outside of marine protected areas in Palau, there's no difference in seagrass decline. So essentially, these habitats are declining whether they're protected from fishing pressure or not.
Okay.
So we know that it's not due to some direct human impact, such as fishing or trawling or anything like that. It's not sort of a physical impact that is causing this. It might be something that has to do with water quality. It might be something that has to do with temperature. But it's some stressor that protecting from physical interference doesn't really get at. So that's what we know so far. And so the work going forward is going to be to kind of, okay, test for some of those stressors that are less physical and maybe more chemical or have to do with temperature or climate change, right? And see which ones are the driving forces. And also, like I said, what have on the community of fish, because a lot of the people there depend on these fish for nutrients. But it's also just out of the sense that culturally these fish are important. Also, I like to believe that life has innate value. And so as much of it we can preserve as possible, the better.
So that leads me to my next question, which is the citizens of Palau, are they aware that the fish population is declining? I mean, like how much are they concerned by what's going on? Because it's an island, it seems like they would be just a little bit more in touch than, say, you know, we who live on the continent.
For sure. So what's really interesting about this project is the people of Palau, so specifically our collaborators at PICRIC, which is just an acronym for Palau International Coral Reef Center, have been monitoring this decline, and they have asked us to sort of help them figure it out with some of the tools that a place like Stanford has access to that maybe not everyone does.
Sure.
So they are very aware of the decline. And I think also Palau is a nation that historically, before they were colonized, but even now after, have always had this culture of stewardship over their natural environment. I think when you live on an island, like you sort of got at in the question, you have closer proximity to these natural resources, but you also rely on them more because you can't just ship them in from another state like we do, right?
Sure.
So I think there's just a tighter link between the people and the nature there. And so they are very aware of these habitat declines, and they do have concerns about it. And one thing that I think is really important in this kind of science that I do is not to do what we call parachute science, which is sort of dropping into an exotic, beautiful place for the sake of our own curiosity to further our own career and not really do anything for the community that relies on those ecosystems. What's really fun about this project for me is that it's not just about me getting this degree or building a career in science. This is very much rooted in the needs and desires of the people in Palau. And I'm sort of just a tool that they're able to use to help them further their understanding of their own ecosystems and make really thoughtful decisions about how they want to proceed. So it's really a fun exchange of knowledge rather than sort of an extractive kind of interaction that I think historically, especially marine biology and sciences rooted in the natural world have kind of taken on.
So tell me, what are some of the, in this collaboration, what are some of the insights that you've been able to get from the actual people of Palau themselves, and what have you been able to help them with?
Yeah, so I think what's great about being able to collaborate with the people in Palau, especially the researchers, is no one is going to know that environment better than they do. I can have all the classes and all the technical skills, and a lot of them do as well. But no matter how educated I am, if I go to Palau and they've been living there their whole life, they're going to have a better knowledge of what's normal and what isn't, or what to expect in those environments. So that's something that's been really helpful, is having their advice on what is baseline, what changes are worrying, what species are important to them, not just for consumption and nutrients, but like economically. So kind of tying in the social aspect of this, those are all things that I wouldn't know. Culturally, what matters to them? Those are things I wouldn't know. The same way, if they came to Sacramento, I would probably have a better grip on the whereabouts and the people and what we value than they might. And I think having their insight in that really helps us focus the science on what's really important rather than whatever I'm curious about. I think having curiosity is great, but I really like to have purpose behind what I'm seeing and making sure that it's bigger than just myself and what I think is interesting. But also, I think what I'm able to bring to them is Stanford has a lot of resources, but also I have the time, because I'm doing a PhD, to learn a lot of skills that some of the researchers there don't have time to invest in. So the amount of monitoring they're doing, the amount of observations they're making about their ecosystem, it takes a lot of time and energy, and they just don't have the bandwidth to learn some of these new skills, some of these new protocols. And because I'm in my PhD, that's sort of what it's all about, is learning new skills and finding ways to apply them creatively. So I'm able to bring that to the table, and I think they're really able to bring like a solid knowledge of the environment and just what's important to them.
Oh, that is incredible to me. That I love. That's what I kind of love about scientists, is that willingness to pool resources, both intellectual and physical resources, to just get the job done. So I applaud you for that.
Thank you. And I think at this point, we do just need to get the job done, because we are kind of, we're, not to be bleak, but we don't have a lot of time to figure some of this stuff out. And so I think the more that we can collaborate with each other and pool resources for the benefit of all of us, the better we're going to be. And because Palau has such a hot spot of biodiversity, I think it's really important that we do pool some of our resources there and in places around the world that are similar.
So I know that things are dire, you know, everywhere you look, things are getting a little, you know, the temperatures are heating up and we're getting closer and closer. But is there anything that gives you hope? Anything where you're like, it looks like they're working over here on it and it's kind of working. Is there anything like that that you've witnessed?
Yeah, I think especially when you're working in this field, you get to know a lot of people who do really care and who are putting in as much effort and resources as they possibly can to solving these problems. And that definitely gives me hope. I think especially working with people who are so closely related to their environment and, mm-hmm. and do care so much in a way that you don't always see here. I think that gives me hope. But I think even beyond the human aspect of it, one thing that has always fascinated me about nature, like I said, the idea that there's so many ways to be alive, is just that evolution finds a way. And Jurassic Park has been one of my favorite movies since I was little. And mm-hmm. one thing they always say is life finds a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. And there are a lot of examples, especially in the marine world, where life is finding a way. Now, that's not to say the consequences won't matter because life will find a way. But it is to say that there is resilience. There are cases of resilience. For instance, there's a lab here on campus that studies the genetics of corals mm-hmm. and how certain corals are more resilient to heat stress than others. And so there is this genetic variation that allows for certain species of corals to live through large-scale bleaching events and to replenish the population.
Oh.
And while there is still work to be done to make sure that we can maintain a lot of this biodiversity, and that's really important,
mm-hmm.
I find it really inspiring when we do find cases where life is able to find a way in spite of us.
That's beautiful. Now, and this is just a question for you directly, which is, in your research, what thing have you learned that really just sort of blew your mind?
Yeah, that's, I'm gonna have to think about that one. I think it's so interesting just because in a PhD program, you're constantly learning.
Mm-hmm.
And so to pick one is a little bit difficult. But what I will say is, I think the most important thing that I've learned so far that we can all kind of take with us to some extent
mm-hmm.
is how connected our human world is to nature and how much we have to consider both at the same time, right? So mm-hmm. I think historically and even now, a lot of people think of humanity as separate from the natural world.
Mm, yeah.
And we think of scientists who work in nature as completely different fields than people who are working in social sciences or humanities or economics. And I think one thing I'm learning is that with the climate crisis and the issues that we're facing now,
mm-hmm.
if we don't kind of take a holistic approach to that, we're going to miss things and people are going to suffer. The life that we want to protect is going to suffer, right? So I think especially because of the background I come from, the idea that if we only consider nature and we don't consider people, a lot of us are going to be left out.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the solutions that we come up with aren't going to apply to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times the people who are negatively affected by these things are disproportionately Black and brown people, right?
Right.
And so I think what's standing out to me is the importance of intertwining, okay, this is the science we're doing. This is the nature we want to preserve. This is the way that climate change is affecting us with, okay, what does that mean for the human world? If we close off this area as a marine sanctuary, how does that affect the people who rely on it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think initially, as climate change became more and more of like a hot button issue,
mm-hmm.
people's focus was protect nature, protect nature, protect nature. And that's important. But I do think we have to make sure that we don't forget about people in the scope of that. And I think there are ways that that can be done,
mm-hmm.
but we really have to do work that studies these things as a complete system, not as a human world separate from a natural world.
Okay. Now, if you were to recommend some reading for our listening audience, maybe their kids, what would you recommend for them to understand more about what you do?
Yeah, I am less of a reader.
Or a movie. I know, because you...
Because I'm
an incredible Mr. Limpet kind of gal, and you're a Little Mermaid kind of gal, so, you know.
Yeah, I'm a Little Mermaid, Jurassic Park kind of gal, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I think if you're interested in coral reefs specifically, there is a documentary on Netflix that talks about coral bleaching.
Mm-hmm.
It came out a while ago, and let me see if I can remember what it's called, but that one's pretty good. If you haven't seen My Octopus Teacher yet, that one's really good. It just kind of delves into some of the beauty and intelligence that life in the sea could have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you're starting early and you are a child and you're kind of just interested in what this world has to offer or what I do, I think for me that was really sparked by the initial curiosity of how beautiful life is. And so that documentary about coral is called Chasing Coral.
Okay.
And that's a really good one to understand sort of the climate effects on
mm-hmm.
some of these environments
mm-hmm.
and some of the work that people are doing to mitigate those things. But yeah, I think those are some good places to start if you're really just trying to spark that curiosity or get a better understanding of what we're facing from a marine standpoint when it comes to climate change and the world changing around us.
And if people want to find out or want to monitor the work that you're doing, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, so my handles on Instagram and Twitter are both Sienna, just my name, so Ceyenna, which mm-hmm. is spelled a little differently, but I hope that you can all remember that. I will say I'm not as active as I would like to be yet on social media. But that said, if you go to Stanford's website for mm-hmm. Hopkins Marine Station,
mm-hmm.
My profile and my email are there. And so if people have questions or interested in a career like this and not sure how to get into it or interested in my work, they can always email me there. And I check my email every day. So any of those avenues will definitely work. And I hope that I hear from some of you out there.
And you are one of the Wonderfest envoys. How did you get involved with them?
Yeah, so I think I have a great relationship with some of the faculty members on campus, mm-hmm. and some of them have had students who have done it before, and so I was nominated through one of those faculty members.
Oh,
but
very
I think
nice.
What was really the connecting point for me and the faculty member that nominated me was that coming from the background I come from, I think it's very clear that science isn't always communicated in a way that's accessible to everyone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's not communicated in a way where it's stressed how important it is to everyone. And so I kind of would like to, in my career, try to bridge that gap a little bit where we can talk about science in a way that everybody can be included, everyone can be involved, and we can also acknowledge how important it is that we do involve these people because it does affect people differently, like I touched on before. And so giving people the opportunity to participate in these discussions and the information they need to do so with information and power and knowledge and understanding of how they can fight for themselves and others, I think that's something that I'm really passionate about. So scientific communication is something I'm trying to get better at. And I think the Science MOA program has been a great start at practicing some of those skills and just putting myself out there so that hopefully as I get more well-versed and further along in my career, I can do some of that connecting on a larger scale.
Well, on that note, Sienna Tillman, I want to thank you so much, not just for being such a trooper when modern technology was being persnickety, but for all the work and all of the thoughtfulness behind the work that you're doing. I really appreciate that. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
The singing sea, the talking trees are silent in a noisy way. The but give no light. The world spins backwards every day.
Hey, look at that.
A rainbow rat, a checkered cat. Go tell and tell. Sun is shining hot and cold.
That's the Singing Sea, number two. That's from the Cowboy Bebop CD box. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Now that you guys all know that over the years I've spoken about many different shotgun players, productions that I've seen and enjoyed, and there's another shotgun thing happening. Hooray, hooray! It's almost like the pandemic never happened. Here to talk about a new production called Babes in, I'm going to say Holand because that's me. I'd like to welcome Lee Rondon Davis. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being on the show today. Now, you're directing the show, correct?
Yes, I am. I am. I have the immense honor of directing Babes in Holand. You said it correctly, over at Shotgun Players in Berkeley. And yeah, it's been a really beautiful, long journey to get to this point. We opened on Saturday night, and we're very excited to be welcoming in audiences to see the show.
Ooh, so you're already open. That's awesome. So before we get into the show, how long have you been a director?
I have been directing for probably the past 4 years now, but it was actually right after, or I guess we're still in the midst of a pandemic, but it was during the pandemic where I started to lead direct more professionally, starting with my first show over at NCTC and then a couple of other projects leading up till now.
So what was it about a pandemic that made you think, I want to direct a bunch of people?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I had always been interested in directing, but was just assisting at certain theaters or working on specific projects as an associate, sort of understanding the full totality of the role. And then there sort of came what felt like this resurgence of, like, really beautiful queer stories and stories centering, like, women and femmes, BIPOC women and femmes, that really spoke to me. And I think I felt that re-energized passion to step more into directing in order to, like, lift up stories from my community, stories that spoke so closely to me and my lived experience. So it's been really beautiful seeing some of the work come out of the Bay and be able to support it, and then to now say, you know, I was the director of that project, or one of the creative leads on that project.
Now,
it's been really special.
Now, was it challenging to make your directorial debut during a time when basically people weren't even supposed to be around one another?
Yeah, it certainly was. I mean, we started the process for Babes back in 2021, and we were supposed to open early 2022 and ultimately decided to postpone just because of where we were at in the COVID surge. And we were learning a lot at that time about what it means to return to in-person theater while during a pandemic. And so, after postponing that first year, I'm so grateful for Shotgun because they, you know, just doubled down on their commitment to support me and this project and this team. So we made a plan to bring it back now. And I think it's been beautiful to see full houses and people returning. Shotgun also has some really incredible accessibility policies. We offer masked matinees on some of the Sundays during the run. So folks that are immunocompromised, we're not, you know, fully ready to be out and unmasked with a group of 100 strangers, can still come and enjoy the work and experience the magic of live theater. But we're also doing streaming and on demand. So I feel like, you know, the amazing accessibility measures that Shotgun is taking is allowing folks to like come in and enjoy theater wherever and however they're comfortable doing so. And I think Bay Area theater is really struggling right now. We're not seeing audiences return in the same way. We are still trying to navigate how do we protect our artists and our audiences during this time, but also still make this magical thing that is live theater. And so I think we're still sort of in like a learning curve, growth edge moment, but it's been really heartening to see all these full houses coming out for Babes and getting to experience the show.
Excellent, excellent. Well, with that, why don't you tell us about Babes in Holland and why it's called that, what the plot is?
Yeah. So Babes in Holland is an incredible new play by New York-based playwright Deneen Reynolds-Knott. It is set at the University of Pittsburgh in the winter of 1996. So we have this very specific time setting. And for those that know, there is a all women and female dorm called Holland Hall at Pitt. And so one of the characters lives in this dorm. And of course, with all the patriarchy and misogyny out in the world, you can't have an all women and femme space without giving it some sort of derogatory name.
Sure.
So students jokingly refer to Holland Hall as Holland. So that's where we get part of the name. Also, a beautiful thing about this script is that it is filled with references to or the girls listening to all of the popular tracks of this time in the 90s. And Deneen really intentionally focused on girl R&B and the Riot Girl girl punk scene.
Oh,
so we're
sweet.
Hearing all of these femme voices from different genres and how each of the young women characters relate to this music. And so Babes in Toyland was a huge band during this time period, still is. And so the title comes from Babes in Toyland and Holland Hall, also lovingly referred to as Holland, giving us Babes in Holland.
Excellent.
And the play itself is this really beautiful, fun coming of age, love story, and, you know, your freshman year experience. I think it's filled with a lot of that nostalgia from the first time you were away from home, the first time you fell in love, the first time you made a friend and fell out with that friend. So I think it's a piece that's really relatable. And the responses from audience have been so cool. The second they walk in and see our dorm room set, they're like, I had that poster. Oh my God, this is exactly what my room looked like freshman year. And then they get to sort of sit in the warm and fuzzy feelings and be brought back to these early adulthood experiences along with the characters. And that feels so special to share with, you know, audiences each night.
So the actors who are inhabiting the roles, are they young people sort of fresh out of college? How are they relating to the, you know, because you mentioned the nostalgia, and of course when you think about your college years, you think about them very fondly and you want to share them with everybody. Do they get it shared with them a lot?
Yeah. I mean, what's really interesting is that our actors sort of span a number of age ranges from like early to mid 30s to early to mid 20s. And that's actually our entire creative team. So for some folks, like this, some of the things are feeling familiar, like maybe we weren't in college yet, but like we were alive and cognizant beings during the early to mid 90s. And for some team members, they were very, very young or didn't even exist yet. And so for some folks, it does like transport us back to this time. And for some folks, it's brand new. They've never experienced, so they're learning it real time. And what's really exciting about the project is I was able to do BABES through the Theater Bay Area Director's Residency. It was my capstone project for a while. I was a director in residence at Shotgun. And with the support of the amazing staff and team at Shotgun Players, we created this mentorship program on the show. Mm-hmm. And so most, if not all, of our designers are emerging designers, with this being one of their first professional credits as a lead designer. And we've paired them with very established, caring, thoughtful mentors from the community, folks mm-hmm. that have been working professionally, you know, anywhere from 15 to 40 years, so that they have the support. But it's a little bit different than, our designers assisting those more established folks. Mm-hmm. We are fully supporting their vision and investing resource and energy and time and support into, letting them shine. And so our team, I think, for the most part, is all under 35, getting their starts in theater along with me. You know, this is the second or the third full production I've directed on my own. And so it feels really exciting that the spirit of this play is around young people mm-hmm. at this specific time, and that sort of the intentionality and vision behind it is also to continue to support and celebrate and uplift young people, which feels really exciting and can be really hard in the Bay Area.
Now, did you have a director mentor, or was it like you were thrown in the deep end?
Totally. So I didn't have a specific mentor, but it wasn't like I was in the deep end on my own. Mm-hmm. You know, so many people on the team really supported me. But I was getting really awesome notes from Shotgun staff, mm-hmm. our artistic director, Patrick Dooley, and Joni mm-hmm. McBrien, the development director. And we also had, Shotgun has recently created a role on each production called the Artistic Facilitator. Mm-hmm. And that person is there as a cheerleader for the team, coming in and being a thought partner around the creation of the show. And so one of my dearest friends, Nayela Harper Malvo, was the Artistic Facilitator on this show, and she was so invaluable in terms of receiving notes from all these different places and different folks and filtering them through to me and being in conversation with me about what we were trying to accomplish together as a team mm-hmm. and how do we best bring that forward. And so I felt really, really supported just through Nayela's companionship and really beautiful artistic eye, as well as the whole Shotgun team who's rallied around this project for, 3 years now. And we're so excited and supportive in making it actually come to life.
Well, tell me who the actors are that and what roles they play.
Yeah, so we have Cindiata Allende playing Ciara, who is sort of our central character. Mm-hmm. And then we have Sierra Ice playing Kat, who is Ciara's roommate, a young white woman. And then we have Tierra Allen playing Taryn, who is Ciara's love interest, that we meet and get to see their relationship blossom over the course of the play. And Tierra and Sierra, it's so fun, all the names are very similar. Mm-hmm. Tierra and Sierra have been a part of the project since 2021. And Cindiata joined earlier in 2023 for a workshop we did with Danine, as one of our original actors had to step away. And she has just stepped into this world so beautifully, just really, I think, connects with the character and brings her to life in such an exciting way. They all do. It's been really exciting to, develop this play over the course of several years with mm-hmm. Tierra and Sierra, and then to invite Cindiata in, this year for leading up to this production has been really exciting. And they're just bringing their A game. It's so much fun to watch them have fun on stage mm-hmm. And rock out and give these characters so much life and heart. I think something that we talked a lot about in the process getting to performances was around, it could be really easy to judge these characters or make assumptions about them or mm-hmm. stereotype them in certain ways. Mm-hmm. And what has been so incredible and inspiring to see is how each of the actors have, you know, seen the wholeness and the beauty and the complexity of each of the characters that they're stepping into, and do that without judgment, without without falling into some of those tropes and traps. Sure. Around what does it look like to be a young white woman, or what does it look like to be a young Black woman from a low-income background, right? Mm-hmm. And they just bring so much nuance and truth to each of these roles. And so I'm excited for folks to experience that as well.
And you also mentioned, I'm assuming that we'll hear at least one Babes in Toyland excerpt, but what are some of the other, who are some of the other artists from Days Gone By that you'll be featuring in the soundtrack to Babes in Hoeland?
Yeah, we've got Hole in there. We've got SWV. We've got Escape, we've got Bikini Kill, Slater Kinney. I'm like looking at the list of all the songs from the show. Our scenic designer created this really awesome playlist of like music inspired by some of these genres and these original creators. Mm-hmm. We have Monica in there. I just pulled up the list mm-hmm. of all the songs. Jade, Mary J. Blige, PJ Harvey, L7, those are all songs you're going to hear during the play. But then Alex Fakayade, our sound designer, created this really incredible playlist of girl R&B, Riot Girl, girl punk that spans the ages, right? And so I think Alex said she started this playlist like, you know, starting in the 70s and then sort of leading up to today. Mm-hmm. And so there's so many incredible bands that you don't necessarily hear over in the right. action of the play. But if you're grabbing a drink in the lobby before the show or at intermission, you're hearing some groups that may sound familiar from different, you know, eras.
Sure.
That are also a part of this conversation, this really incredible legacy of women in music.
So you know you're going to have like a sheet playlist because people are going to be asking the whole run of the show.
Oh my gosh, yeah. They have Shotgun, our marketing director, Christy, was so amazing and put little QR codes to both the like the show playlist mm. and the inspiration playlist in the program, so folks have it right there in their hands to scan and listen to on their way home, which I'm really excited about.
Excellent. Well, we're almost out of time, so I want to make sure we tell people where Shotgun is, when the show is playing, and how to get tickets.
Yeah, so Babes in Hoeland, we started this weekend, but we run through, we just extended to February 11th. So tickets are available on Shotgun's website, shotgunplayers.org. And yeah, please come check it out. We're located in Berkeley, right across from the Ashby BART station, one of the most convenient theaters to get to.
True.
And so please come join us for a fun night out at the theater. We've got tasty cocktails and really fun vibes. And you'll see a show that like warms your heart and lifts your spirits.
And if people want to learn more about the Shotgun Theater, where can they find them online?
Yeah, that'll be at shotgunplayers.org as well.
All right. Well, Lee Rondon Davis, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Marilyn. It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Awesome. People of Earth, Babes in Hoeland, Shotgun Theater. I have yet to see a performance that did not blow my socks off. It's just about time for me to turn the mic over to Mr. Ford. It'll be pleasuring your ear hole. So until next week, my friends, ta-ta and tiddly-doo.